today in the Loopcast. I have J.M. Berger, friend of the show, my personal friend, and we're discussing his paper, A Paler Shade of White, Identity and In-Group Critique in James Mason's Siege. So one of the reasons we wanted to do a podcast on James Mason's Siege is we wanted to create like a series on some of the influencers, thinkers, writers behind the white supremacy, white power movement. So it's not just enough to kind of focus on the violent actors or the violent groups, but taking a step back and focusing on some of the ideas, right? I mean, at some surface level, it might be obvious, like, oh, they're Nazis, they're Klansmen. But as we kind of dig in, it's a much more complex sense of creation, of propagation of ideas. So think of it like today is James Mason. Hopefully we're working on getting somebody on Tom Metzger and then Louis Beam and a lot of these people, a lot of these thinkers. So before we start, let me, with JM, he's the author of Extremism, a great top level sort of treatment of the general idea of extremism. He's also the author of Optimal, which is science fiction, but it's still really good. And then a few other books that we'll throw in the description of the show. So with that, please welcome JM. How's it going?
Hey, good to be here.
Awesome. So one of the big struggles for me going into the show was actually finding good sources. So what I found researching the show is that I ran into was that the treatments of Siege were either you or the Southern Poverty Law Center. So it was kind of this weird dynamic of like, there wasn't a lot of writing on Siege. So I guess the first question here is, what is Siege? What is Siege and who is James Mason?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a great point. And it's something that I really ran into in writing this paper is I wanted, you know, sort of the standard format for a paper that I do at this point is that you have a little bit of background and then you have a very lengthy kind of analysis of a text. And, you know, there was really very little on Siege that I could really draw on that had been sort of fleshed out and published. So Siege is a book that is a compilation of newsletter articles from the 1980s written by James Mason, neo-Nazi, who originally was part of the American Nazi Party and then later worked his way through the movement, including founding his own groups. And for several years in the 1980s, he published a newsletter called Siege, and it included a lot of short to long articles about whatever happened to be on his mind. It was a sort of proto blog in a lot of ways. It has the feeling, the tone of a blog. So it, you know, often very personal, often very ranty. And when you compile it into a book, it doesn't really hold together that well. So despite all this, Siege has been very popular. So people pull from it what they need. And it's gone through sort of like a life phase where it sort of came out and elements of it were very controversial. And then people in the movement, you mentioned Tom Metzger, you know, people kept it alive over the course of many years. And then it enjoyed kind of a renaissance with the rise of online forums. And the reason that I think a lot of us are familiar with it now is it's really informed the ideology behind groups like the Adam Waffen Division and its sort of related neo-Nazi groups like the Führerkrieg Division and other, the base as another one. All these groups, you know, refer to themselves sometimes as Siege culture groups, and they draw on Siege to a greater or lesser extent. But Siege is like a massive tome that has very little consistent through line. So it's very hard to actually read. The slogan that a lot of these groups use is like, read Siege, like that's the meme, right? You know, that you should read Siege and then you're going to get, you know, red-pilled or somehow awakened into white nationalism. But in fact, reading Siege is painful, even within the movement. So what we've seen, especially over the last couple of years, is a real sort of repackaging of some of the material into smaller, more digestible chunks, you know, sometimes altering what was originally there as they do so.
So when we talk about Siege's content, what is significant about it? Why why does it, in your view, represent value to study?
So the I picked Siege as part of the sort of wider pattern of study that I'm engaged in as part of my doctorate. My dissertation is looking at how very disparate extremist texts compare to each other. So I'm looking at jihadists, I'm looking at white nationalists. Next up, I'm looking at some of the ideology of slavery in the United States in the pre-Civil War era. And the idea is that by sort of taking a common framework of analysis to each of these works, that you can figure out what all the movements that we sort of label as extremist, what do they have in common? What are the similarities between them? How do they differ from each other? So in sort of working my way through the text, I just, the first one that I decided to do for my dissertation was Abdullah Azzam's Join the Caravan, which is like a very much a classic kind of landmark jihadist text. And I had done similar kind of analysis already on ISIS texts, and I had done similar kinds of analysis in the white nationalist area on Christian identity. And so I wanted something that would sort of stand apart, be advancing the research from what I had done before. So I didn't want to just repeat Christian identity. And I wanted something that, you know, was very current, had sort of obvious influence on existing groups. And I wanted a text that was meaty. So I wanted a text that was pretty substantial. And then with that, I got, you know, possibly more than I bargained for with Siege, because it's more than 160,000 words. So it's like the length of like my nonfiction books, or none of my nonfiction books are that long. So
when we think of Mason, how do we sort of think about his influences? Because he's writing in the 80s, and in the 80s, I mean, it almost seems like in my superficial understanding of it, it seemed kind of like a boom period for white supremacist thinking and white nationalist thinking. But what are some of his contemporaries and some of his influencers? Was he just kind of writing, you know, blogging or, you know, proto-blogging without like these influences, or he's kind of looking at these contemporaries and kind of writing against them and kind of saying, look at what I have to say?
It's really, that's an interesting question, because when you look at the text, so that you can sort of trace some evolution in his influences. So he starts off, you know, really kind of revering George Lincoln Rockwell of the American Nazi Party and a guy named Joseph Tomasi, who formed the National Socialist Liberation Front, which was a splinter from the American Nazi Party after Rockwell's assassination. And he really, you know, I mean, he's just gushes over these guys in particular and their thoughts and ideas. And so a lot of the language he uses and some of the ideas he uses are really taken very directly from Tomasi, especially, you know, the sort of the concept of the system and the sort of heart of an accelerationist kind of strategy, that, you know, the idea that you have to tear down the entire system instead of trying to reform it, instead of trying to appeal to a sort of a mass audience. So Mason is often, when you read Siege, it's full of sometimes very catty insider baseball, obscurantist critiques of people, you know, who I couldn't even tell you who half of them were, you know, at the time in the movement for his newsletter audience, you know, he assumed that these people were easy enough to identify that he didn't have to use their names. And so he'd just be like, you know, oh, well, so-and-so says this, but he's really a grifter, and, you know, and never actually say who they are. And then he exists in some more tension with some of the more prominent figures. So like William Pierce, who is a contemporary who went in a slightly different direction. He is sort of carefully respectful of Pierce, but he does, I think, make an effort to distinguish himself. You know, similar, you know, Metzger, I will say, you mentioned that I had seen some tweets about Siege, and probably in the context of this paper by Dr. Amanda Carpenter, I think. And, you know, talking about Metzger being a big advocate of Siege, which I hadn't known about. I'm aware of Metzger as somebody who's, you know, definitely due for some deeper dives and more coverage. And I believe she's working on something that does that. for him. You know, he's there are other people in the figure, the sort of the order. He's got a sort of friendly attitude toward the order, you know, the violent gang, the white supremacist gang that really tried to bring William Pierce's vision to life. So he's got a sort of positive attitude toward them, but he doesn't really get into it. I mean, most of what he writes about the movement is carefully generic. So he's not, even though he obviously has some very specific axes to grind, he's not really like out to name names in a lot of places. He's clearly interested in picking fights, but he kind of carefully frames it as a discussion of the broader movement. And his critique of the broader neo-Nazi movement and white supremacist movement is that it's too concerned with trying to win hearts and minds, when it should just be trying to tear down the system, to sort of reduce it to its very, very most basic critique. And he eventually becomes so obsessed with this idea, this sort of like, you know, chaotic violence strategy, that he really kind of ties his beliefs in the movement to Charles Manson, who's, you know, not Charles Manson, who's obviously got a lot of Nazi stuff going on, but who's not somebody you necessarily think of as a leader of the white supremacist movement. So that was kind of a controversial thing that he, when he took on Manson, and you know, it's possibly responsible for, you know, the long period that it took for this text to really start inspiring people to violence.
So before we go on, so I just want to establish a timeline. So Siege is published in the 80s, right? The bulk of it, and then kind of repackaged and published again in the 90s, but doesn't hit kind of this popular stride until 2010s. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there were a couple of editions. So there was a collected edition in the 90s. There was another edition in the 2000s. Each one had some degree of revision. I haven't done a comparison of them. I think that'd be a pretty interesting task if one had the patience to read this text over and over again, which I probably wouldn't. I think, but you know, the sort of evolution of how a text evolves over time is really kind of an interesting concept. So, you know, in terms of sort of like we talk about popularity, and it's like really hard to gauge those numbers, you know, what, like from a numerical point of view, like how many people were reading Siege in this time or that time. You know, we can sort of rely on how, you know, Mason would like us to understand it, and we can sort of infer some things. But what I would say is that the text really became more impactful with the rise of the Adam Waffen division and those types of groups. And so a lot of the relatively little stuff that's been written about the history of the book often points to the introduction of the book on the Iron March forums in the mid-2010s as sort of a turning point that really brought it back to the forefront. So even after that, you know, we're talking about objectively not very many people who have actually read this book from start to finish. And even if you broaden that sort of aperture to include people who are familiar with some of the concepts and the reinterpretation of it as Siege culture, we're still really not talking about large numbers of people. But the ideas are kind of influential, and they kind of spill out all over the place. And it's sort of similar to the Turner Diaries, which more people have probably read the Turner Diaries. But the Turner Diaries is wildly influential in the movement, regardless of how many people have read it. And so I would say that Siege has definitely, you know, you can see this kind of accelerationist threads popping up in a lot of different places, and these groups taking notes from it. So, you know, popular, I don't know how to assess that in this context, but impactful, I think we can say with some confidence.
It's kind of interesting. I think you either during this interview or during our kind of pre-interview conversation, you mentioned the meme hashtag Read Siege. And then this idea of siege culture. Can you dig into that? I mean, when somebody says hashtag read siege, like the expectation is they haven't actually read it. They're kind of like vibing it like as a meme, as opposed to like a actual textual going through the document. But explain to us like that meme, read siege, and the idea of siege culture.
Yeah, so the read siege meme, I'm most familiar with it as a sort of recent manifestation of the online popularity of this. Now, you know, obviously people have been encouraging people to read siege for longer than that, but there's kind of the hashtag read siege, you know, is something that has become very widespread in certain kinds of white supremacist circles. Mostly, you know, we would just refer to these groups as siege culture, and they would include Atomoff and Division, Fear Creek Division, the base. They also include, like, there's a network of Telegram channels called the Telegram Network, loosely organized network. I mean, it's not a, you know, I don't want to overstate the coherence of it, but it's very oriented around a lot of these ideas in siege. And so there's a website that they run that's called Siege Culture, and it has a lot of discussions of stuff in siege. I mean, the book is so long and so winding that it's just very hard to digest in its whole. So when I told, you know, some of my fellow scholars, analysts working on this stuff that I was doing this, they were like, you know, I didn't find anybody who had read Siege. Nobody said, oh, yeah, I read Siege. Like, no, they were like, oh, thank God you're doing this because I don't want to read Siege. It's like too long, it's too badly composed. And so and one person said, you know, none of the extremists I know who are into the ideas have really read it either. And so you can see some ways in which that material has been repackaged. So there's the Siege Culture website, there's the Telegram channels, obviously sort of chop it up into, you know, very garish looking images that sort of pull out concepts or quotes. Very more recently, there's been an effort to reduce the book into bullet points. So there's a sort of thematic exploration called the Tenets of Siege, which is like, you know, basically like, you know, here's sort of BuzzFeed listicle about what's in siege. You know, here's 20 things that you should take out of siege. And when you read the 20 things, like, let's just say it's a very different experience from reading the actual book. So
that's kind of interesting. Like it almost seems like that's a comment on kind of the online. You've taken this unruly, you know, esoteric text and you've just kind of made it into a meme, distilled it down to bullet points, and now it's kind of radicalizing people. I don't mean to laugh, but it just seems very like very a product of the online and sort of how information is repackaged and consumed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can see a lot of internet activity as being, you know, the mother bird chewing up the food before vomiting it into the baby bird's mouth, you know. So like a great deal of material that kind of goes into this blender and comes out in, you know, recognizable. It's like recognizably the same thing in a lot of ways, but it's also creates sort of opportunities for texts to evolve and for the meaning of texts to evolve. So, you know, this process of discussion and deconstruction and rehashing and analysis of the analysis that's in siege, you know, creates openings for people to sort of interpolate their own ideas in there. And you can, this is, you know, this used to happen, you know, 2000 years ago, this happened when in the process of sort of copying texts, you know, because everything had to be copied by hand, the person who copied it might make little corrections, you know, or make a mistake that then became part of the text that became sort of memorialized and eventually enshrined as a canonical, you know, element of belief. So in a digital age, you don't have the transcription process anymore. Instead, what you have is this kind of interpretation and discussion process that really, you know, is a way to sort of reframe and evolve the ideas in something that's been around before. And, you know, some groups rely on the internet to provide some stability. So like in Christian Identity, for instance, there's like really a lot of big archives of old Christian Identity writings, you know, that are preserved in a way that hadn't been possible before, you know, or hadn't been practical before, I would say. You know, you could build up a library of Christian Identity stuff in Idaho, but nobody's ever going to see it. Whereas if you post it online, then you can sort of promulgate it. So the digitization of the text, in one hand, lets you make reference to the original in ways that you know might have been difficult before. If you look at, you know, the sermons of Wesley Swift, for instance, a Christian Identity preacher, you know, he's always referring to what was in the books, right? You know, he's referring to the scholars, and a lot of that stuff was like British Israelism and other sort of seminal ideas, theories, historical theories and ideologies that evolved into Christian Identity. And because he just hit this by reference, he would just say, oh, well, the scholars, if you go to the British Museum, that was one of his favorite lines, if you go to the British Museum, you'll be able to read the books yourself. And then, but then he would just like, you know, give some wildly inaccurate description of what was in the book, and that would become the new ideology. So now you have this culture where you have these texts exist and are accessible to anybody, and, you know, as digital artifacts that, you know, you can, to some extent, the text itself stabilizes, and then the discussion and interpretation, it does a lot of the heavy lifting of how it's going to play out.
That's interesting, because like what I understand of CGIST acceleration almost seems to be, I mean, let's step back. Like, what is CGIST accelerationism, or how is accelerationism defined within this siege culture? And then is it really far away, or really far away from what Mason laid out? Or is it like this kind of weird, you know, edited, you know, we took some parts out, we left some parts in sort of accelerationism?
So I'll say a little about that, but I don't want to overstate how closely I'm following the online debates about this. So, I mean, one of the decisions I made in sort of framing my dissertation was that I was going to work from key texts, because you need, for what I want to do in terms of understanding extremism as a, you know, comparative cross-ideological subject of study, you have to have some stable texts to work. Otherwise, it just becomes madness. So in the paper I did on British Israelism, for instance, I mean, I think, you know, there's clear value in doing a study like that that traces something over time to see the evolution, to see all the different influences that go into it. But for this particular phase of my work, I'm really interested in just, you know, comparing stable texts as much as possible. So I'm aware, you know, and do a little dabbling in reading how Siege is contextualized by the people who follow it, but it's not the primary focus of what I do. So all that being said, you know, I am aware of it to some extent, and, you know, and often as it's interpreted for me by other people who I know are working on it. And what I see is that Siege is because Siege is a sort of anthology of short articles, right? It's not like a narrative that Siege is really trying to, you know, like we're going to, it's not like an academic dissertation where, you know, here's the introduction, we're going to tell you what we're going to talk about, and then we talk about it, and then we're going to tell you what we just talked about. You know, it's not like that. It's really just like a collection of often very disconnected, sometimes even contradictory articles about different elements of white supremacy. So in some ways, it really lends itself to a pick and choose approach, because not many people are going to sit down and read all 160,000 words of Siege. And out of the people who do read it, not many of them are going to want to do the work to try and make it into a coherent. So I think that, you know, with a text like this, it's pretty easy to just sort of pick and choose what you like and ignore what you don't like. And so, you know, the accelerationism piece of this is something that accelerationism, the word accelerationism doesn't appear in the text. It's a later later description than an accurate description of a concept that, you know, has shown up in a variety of different kind of ideological contexts over the years. And it essentially, accelerationism is the belief that you can, as a strategy, that you can engage in what seems like random violence as long as it's damaging the system. So the idea is that you're going to tear down the existing system in order that something new can rise up in the vacuum that follows, as opposed to, you know, what the Taliban's doing, for instance, which is like strategically trying to impose its rule over an area. Accelerationism in many ways is sort of, you know, it's a strategic cop-out. You don't have to do the work of designing the society that's going to take place of the one that exists. You don't have to do the work of trying to hold territory or win popular opinion. You just can kind of rip things down. And so that, you know, arguably attracts a certain kind of adherent, you know, who is more prone to violence and is looking for a justification for a violent impulse, maybe more than necessarily having a fully articulated ideology. So if you take that to, you know, its sort of greatest extreme, you'd have something like the Boogaloo movement, where there's virtually, you know, no ideology except for accelerationism. Siege is not that far down the road. So siege, accelerationism is still, it's in the service of white racial supremacy. And what to me was the more interesting kind of finding out of the text was that siege takes its accelerationist viewpoint because the author, Mason, has a dismal view of the in-group, the racial in-group that he's supposedly trying to promote, white people. So, you know, the crux of this and the bad pop culture pun in the title really comes from having read Siege and sort of reading it, not just, you know, like analytically and thematically, but also just kind of numerically. You just like look at it and see like how many sections of this book, how many words in this book are about white people versus non-white people that are in the outgroup that makes you an extremist, right? So, you know, you think of a neo-Nazi text, you think of it as being a diatribe against people who are not white. And it is that to some extent. But just in terms of the actual, you know, when you look at the content and really like try and assess how much of the book is about the outgroup of non-white people versus a critique of the in-group, there's just vastly more critique of the in-group. And what was really interesting to me was that this was consistent with other extremist texts that I've studied over the years, and both in the dissertation and in other contexts. Is something that I just find, you know, I go into this sort of thinking about, you know, the definition of extremism as being, you know, focused on conflict with an outgroup, an in-group's conflict with an outgroup and promoting the supremacy of an in-group. And you know, might think when, if that's the framework, that these texts are going to be mostly about how good the in-group is and how bad the out-group is, and they're not. They're often, almost overwhelmingly, the important texts are really about how the in-group is failing to confront the threat of the out-group and how the in-group has become corrupted or complacent or, you know, otherwise gone down the wrong direction, and that the extremist group is necessary to bring that up. And some of that, this is part of the reason why I wanted to do the ideology of slavery in the United States, is the next phase of my analysis. You can attribute some of that to a movement like, you know, organization or Al-Qaeda or ISIS or neo-Nazis, Siege, National Socialist Liberation Front. These are all like fringe movements, right? So they're not popular with the in-group that they're seeking to represent. And so their texts have to address that, and they have to rationalize that somehow. What's interesting in looking at slavery, the practice of slavery, is that the practice of slavery has much more support in American society during the period that it really becomes very ideologically distinct. And so, you know, what I'm going to be looking for as I enter this next phase of research is how do the advocates of slavery address their in-groups, and who do they understand to be their in-groups? Are the advocates of slavery advocating for white people, or are they advocating for Southerners specifically? And, you know, and how does that play out in the sort of description and the analysis? And what you, it's really, there's a lot of stuff that I guess is not what you might intuitively grasp for. When you're looking at it, to me at least. I mean, somebody else might, you know, come at this maybe a better grasp of it or a more sophisticated viewpoint and sort of look at this and say, you know, oh, well, this is obvious. But to me, it wasn't obvious. And really, you know, not just the existence of the in-group critique, which I think everybody kind of understands that the extremist group's always going to have that, but really the volume and focus and just how important the in-group critique is. And in Siege, as in Join the Caravan, the in-group critique is the most important thing, much more important than critique of the out-group. So, you know, so my dissertation, you know, is exploring how different extremist movements at different points in their history approach this question of in-group critique and other things. And then what are the things that sort of unite these? How are these different, these very different contexts? How do they produce something that is recognizably extremist, even though they're coming from very different places? That was a very long-winded answer.
So I'm curious then if within Siege, no political vision is articulated. No sort of the end state is a, you know, Nazi state, is a caliphate, is a, you know, slaveholding state or whatever. It's all about the violence. Is that correct?
Yeah, not in any kind of detail. So if you look at, the Turner Diaries as being sort of a, you know, comparable piece from a similar period in the movement, the Turner Diaries does, you know, sketch out this, the idea of a utopian white state. It does not get into very much detail at all about what that state would look like or how it's going to operate, but it does, that sort of outcome, that goal was always there. And, you know, it's sort of baked into the framing mechanism of the novel, actually. And so what you get out of that is a sense that there is, you know, we are working towards something, as opposed to Siege, where you're really just interested in tearing down the system. And the idea is that eventually something good will emerge and take its place. But there's even less detail than, I mean, you know, what's in the Turner Diaries is incredibly vague, but it's there. It's a presence. It's an idea. And you really don't see that idea in Siege. You don't see him sort of waxing about what this perfect white society might look like. He's just about how bad the current society is and how it has to go.
So then, kind of flash forward to now, when we think about Siegist accelerationism versus sort of accelerationist tendencies expressed in, let's say, the Christian identity movement, how do those two kind of compare, you know, and what is that? Is there a tension? How does that, how do those two strains kind of navigate each other?
Well, Christian identity is really kind of an apocalyptic millenarian religious movement, right? So there is sort of a rough biblical vision of what's there, what it's there to promote. And a lot of people who are involved in Christian identity often have very elaborate views about the Constitution and the role of the Constitution and what the ideal American government is like. So, you know, like Posse Comitatus, one of the most important Christian identity, you know, oriented movements, really brought us kind of the sovereign citizen ideas and the constitutional sheriff ideas. And they took from the tax protester movement to really, you know, they articulate something that, while it may not be coherent or make a lot of sense or be practical, it's, you know, definitely an alternative system that they're promoting. And Siege is really, and you can speculate about why this is. You know, part of it probably comes from the movement. Part of it probably comes from Mason himself, from Mason feeling like he's under siege from other people in the movement. You can hear in the text, you know, his dissatisfaction with people who criticize him and his own criticisms of other people in the movement. And everybody else in the movement is a grifter and a charlatan, whereas he's the only, you know, true Scotsman. And, you know, so some of that, you know, is probably driven by personal axes that he's out to grind. But, you know, the fact is that that's not, you know, he's not alone in doing this. So I was struck by the similarities. I mean, if you look at, you know, Abdullah Azzam and Join the Caravan, I mean, as a personality is about as different from James Mason as you could possibly imagine. You know, he's like an actual fighter. He like, you know, threw everything in his life away to go after this cause. He's like a huge into organization. He articulated, you know, beliefs about where the movement was going to go that have shaped things to, you know, just shaped the entire world today. And, you know, and he did it all as a really kind of powerful force pushing this ideology. And if you look at Mason, he's nothing like Azzam. He is a, you know, he carps and complains and makes excuses for himself. And he has not been a fighter. He's not led a movement in any meaningful way, any large group of people. And yet, both of these texts really have very similar critiques about people in the in-group. So I guess for me, that what's interesting and some of my interest in this is fueled by my interest in machine learning and how, you know, how we can use algorithmic techniques and how we can use other kinds of analysis to identify extremist movements, identify extremist content. And so if you were like, you know, setting out for a social media company to write a program that's going to detect extremist content, you know, naturally you're thinking about, you know, and you can see this in the research too. And like in the course of my own research, like when people come to me with an idea, they're always looking for like, you know, we found all these racial slurs and if you search for these racial slurs and you can find extremists on the internet to take them off the internet, and like, yay. And it's like, okay, but you're capturing racism. You're not necessarily capturing extremism. So racism is just having negative views about people in an outgroup, right? In a racial outgroup, whereas racial extremism is having negative views about people in an outgroup and insisting that you as a member of the in-group must kill those people or harm them in some tangible way. And so when we're looking at the text, one of the things an approach I discarded pretty early in my dissertating process. I had this idea for a fairly novel way to, you know, do the bag of words analysis that, you know, would help bring forward some insights about what's in these extremist texts. The approach is actually fruitful, and I'll do something else with it at some point. But, you know, because of basically my advisor, Alistair Reed, said to me, you know, you're trying to do too many different things here. Narrow it down. Like, and so I decided to narrow it down to the theory and put the, you know, bag of words analysis aside. But ultimately, you know, I think we all have an interest in sort of using these techniques to understand, both to understand what's in a long text like Siege, and also to identify extremist content when it pops up online. And basically the sort of theoretical pieces that I'm doing, that I did on Join the Caravan, that I'm doing on Siege, the work I did on British Israelism, and some of the work I did on ISIS propaganda, and it all sort of points to the same thing, which is that if you really want to capture extremist activity, you know, using this kind of analytical framework, it needs to include the in-group critique because the in-group critique is something that distinguishes you from being a pedestrian racist and makes you into someone who is more interested in organizing a social movement.
So I think like we don't have to discuss the out-group because I think you know, you've already explained that Mason is a Nazi. You kind of can get, you know, who's the out group in this case. Sorry. Yeah. But
not too hard to figure out his out group.
Not too hard. But what does Mason see as the in group, right? So, you know, who's eligible, who's not eligible? Is it, you know, how does he define and sort of set the parameters for the in group?
Well, that's really sort of getting at the question here. So, yeah, I mean, one reason that extremists may not talk about the out-group so much is that they are, their text, especially an ideological text, is often aimed at people who are already part of the way down the road. So you already think the out-group's bad, and it's just a question of what are you going to do about it. So where this really gets interesting, I think, in racial extremism is that you can be thrown out of the in-group. Basically, so you have this movement that is arguing on the one hand for race as an absolute biological fact, an incontrovertible fact of race. You cannot deny the biological grounds of race to be in this movement. And at the same time, they're also saying, if you aren't sufficiently pure in the in-group, then we're going to throw you out of the in-group. So the racial boundary is like, you know, is like absolutely impermeable for somebody from the out-group trying to get into in-group status, but people in the in-group can be thrown out of it based on a purity test. So it really kind of highlights to me, in an interesting way, really highlights the inconsistency of a racial supremacist doctrine. And, you know, you can see this in movements over time more than you can see it in Mason's work specifically. So Mason really has a very, you know, fundamentally, he believes that you have to be biologically white, but you also have to act white. And if you don't act white, then you're not white. So it's kind of a two-pronged definition there. Where I think it gets kind of interesting is more when you look at these things over time and sort of the evolution of who gets to be white. And then the study of British Israelism that I did sort of got into that, because you started off with, you know, British Israelism started off with like a really innocuous kind of theory that British people were actually the lost tribes of Israel. And so essentially white people were Jews and everybody was all together. And it slowly changed over the course of, you know, decades, you know, in the course of trying to defend this idea that the British were the lost tribes of Israel. Eventually it started arguing that the British were better than the people who were already known to be Jews, and that the lost tribes were the better tribes. And then eventually, you know, you argue that white people and Jews are completely separate. You start layering in these weird genealogical things that really sort of define Jewishness away from whiteness. And then even more than that, you know, what you find in sort of reading these books over the course of decades is that, you know, like the definition of white starts off as initially, like, you know, this is a ideology that's very much about Anglo-Saxons specifically. And then it sort of says, well, what about Scandinavians? What about Teutonic? What about Italians? Are Italians white? That's pretty dubious, you know, and they go through this kind of calculus of, you know, either shrinking or expanding the group based on whatever the tactical needs of the day are. So if you're, you know, you're trying to win more support for the group, then you have a bigger pool of white people to recruit from. Or if your group is already big enough, if for your personal preferences and what you want is for the group to be more action oriented, then you might impose a purity test and start excluding people. So, you know, where you draw these lines around the in-group becomes a really kind of increasingly narrow and consequential question. And Mason has a really just incredibly restrictive view of who counts as white. And anybody who participates in the system, in the corrupt system, anybody who collaborates with people who are non-white in any way, they are out. They are not white as far as Mason is concerned.
Okay, so then you have this group, this huge eligible group of white people, who don't collaborate, white people who don't work with the system, et cetera. How do we go from that eligibility group to the extremist in group?
I would say that the part of the problem that Mason has and the reason that we go to this accelerationist sort of standpoint is that the eligible in-group under his definition of eligibility is not that big. So, you know, if you're paying taxes and you work in a integrated workplace, then you're already like got one foot out the door as far as he's concerned. So, you know, his demand for purity really reduces the available people very low. So he really, to qualify as a true white person in Mason's view, you have to be in the extremist movement already. And then even then, if you're a neo-Nazi or a white supremacist who's trying to win popular support, who's pursuing, you know, nonviolent means, even those people, even if you're fully committed to this kind of out-group hate and white supremacy as a longer term goal, for Mason, if you're not doing something about it, then you are risking being disqualified. You're risking becoming part of the ineligible in group.
And you have the in-group, the extremist in-group. What is sort of, in Mason's view, the narrative that is driving the need to have these increasingly more extreme sort of versions of the in-group?
So, you know, he talks about a lot of stuff, and it's you can take it at face value, or you can, I think reasonable people can question, you know, what's driving his kinds of things. So, you know, his face value kind of argument is one about corruption, and it's about decadence and complacency, and that the in-group is, you know, failing to take the necessary action, that they're too comfortable, that they're benefiting from a system that is otherwise not good for white people and not good for the white racial purity. And, you know, a lot of his argument is focused on that. But what you can also see in here, and what you can see in some of these other extremist texts, is that there's a pure, what some people call purity spiral. So I would call it a legitimacy spiral. So when you are an extremist who is not part of mainstream, you know, so you're in a group like Mason, or, you know, that you're advancing a view that is not widely shared, you get criticized for that. So people in the in-group criticize you and say, you know, this is bullshit. We're not doing this. This is, you know, you guys are extremists and we don't like you. And your response to that dictates sort of the direction of the movement. So you know, in a very grossly oversimplified way, there are two kinds of responses. You can try and be more popular by softening your views so that more people will like them. Or you can go on the attack and say that the people who are criticizing you are wrong and in fact possibly part of the out-group themselves. So ultimately, I think there's a big element of legitimacy that runs through this stuff, and that I've talked about a lot in my work, is that when a legitimacy of a movement, an extremist movement, is challenged, you have to respond in some way, or else you risk irrelevance. So you have to have some kind of response when somebody criticizes you, somebody from your in-group criticizes you. So that response has to, A, rationalize the fact that people in the in-group don't agree with you, because if the in-group is everything, then you should probably want the in-group's approval more than anything. So if the in-group's not giving that approval, then you really have to come up with a good reason why that's not happening. And then secondly, challenges to legitimacy force innovation. So you have to, when you're challenged, somebody says your white supremacist neo-Nazi movement is not legitimate, it's where we don't approve of it, your ideas are bad. And so in the process of defending your ideas, you almost always elaborate those ideas. So you add to those ideas. And so the ideas shift and evolve and often become more extreme in that process. So because you're being forced to defend your ideas, you write, you know, 20,000 words about your ideas that you wouldn't have had to write before. And in those 20,000 words, maybe some new ideas creep in, and then you rinse and repeat, you know, over the course of many years or generations. And you, what you find is that the movement is evolving in ways that the original ideologues may not have expected at all.
So within this sort of tension between the eligible in-group, the extremist in-group, and then the extremist, the real extreme in-group, you know, how does Mason conceptualize violence? Is it just for him, like, just a matter of tearing down the system and everybody will kind of default to that extremist position? Or is there more like a strategic and sort of tactical view of violence? Like you use violence and you slowly get people to realize that the system is corrupt and needs to be torn down.
So a lot of extremists are interested in that kind of awakening violence, you know, violence as a tool for awakening people. And Mason really is just interested in tearing down the system. And I think his, you know, embrace of Charles Manson to some extent sort of epitomizes that. He picks Charles Manson singles him out as a figure whose primary claim to fame is doing violence, and he is what he's known for, and his violence, Manson's violence, is not obviously strategic in any way. And it's just you damage the system until it can't function anymore. And for Mason, the commitment to violence, even though Mason himself is relatively, certainly not the most, you know, have the longest, most notorious rap sheet out of all these guys that we've seen, you know, the commitment to the idea of violence is really, for him, is just paramount. So if you are not actively encouraging people to take part in violence and taking part in violence yourself and supporting those people who do take part in violence, then that's it. You're out of the in-group, essentially.
So then there's no real fluidity in sort of his creation of in-groups and out-groups, or in the in-group. So in that sense, you can only go one way. You can only become more extreme and more violent. There's no sort of walking back. There's no there's only one route, right, in this conception.
Yeah, so the one-way nature of this is a pretty common theme in white racial supremacy. So, you know, you can be disqualified from whiteness, but you can never qualify into whiteness. And that sort of that dynamic, the one-way nature of that traffic, does set you up for a purity spiral immediately, you know, because if you can only be impure, you can't like earn purity, then, you know, that's the way things are going to go, then that's going to shape everything that follows. And so that's I think a key difference between racial and religious extremist movements, because most religious extremist movements will allow you to convert to join the movement. So you can become, if you are, you know, we're talking about ISIS or Al-Qaeda, you can join their in-group pretty easily, actually. I mean, you know, you have to say a few words and you have to express a few opinions and you are in, you are part of the in-group. And so, you know, what's interesting, curious and interesting to me, and I would not describe my thoughts on this as being extremely sophisticated at this point. It's more like nascent sort of ideas that I'm turning over in my head. But, you know, I thought at one point, when I was sort of thinking about these things in general principles, it's like, you know, racial boundaries are much more absolute and unforgiving than religious boundaries, where you can literally just decide to join somebody's religious in-group, even if that person's an extremist. And shouldn't, you know, you would think, I guess, in a very abstract, rarefied way, you would think that the more rigid boundary would be the more violent group. And when you look at ISIS, for instance, you know, you certainly, I mean, you know, we're talking about movements here that all elements of these movements are horrific, are capable of horrific violence. So you've got ISIS and you've got Nazis, and they're both capable of, you know, what I would say is meaningfully horrific violence. Like, the Nazis industrialized it in a way that was, you know, has little precedent in history, as opposed to ISIS, which is didn't necessarily systematize the violence, industrialize it in the same way that Nazis did, but they certainly leaned into particularly horrific and spectacle-oriented violence. So, you know, I mean, I guess the point is, you know, this rigidity of the in-group boundary doesn't seem to be obviously a factor in how violent a group is going to be or what kind of violence they're going to take part in. And I think that there's, you know, what I would say in, you know, my thinking about this is that it's really, there's room for really more, really kind of interesting, considered research and analysis on this. And maybe when I finish my dissertation, that'll be what I work on, or maybe it'll be for somebody else to pick up, you know, down the road. But I think that there, that question of rigidity of group membership and its relation to how the group behaves, I think, is just kind of fascinating. And I haven't seen a lot of stuff that really explores it in detail.
That's interesting, because in the paper, you kind of touch on, you know, that, and you've touched on in the conversation, is that you have Mason and you have Azzam, who are both kind of critiquing the in-group, but at the same time, you know, you've made this point that, you know, racial extremism seems to be a lot more less fluid, seems to be a lot less fluid than kind of religious extremism. Is, you know, is there a comment about kind of sieges? You know, how does it inform us about the fluidity of identities and ideas within the in-group? And, you know, how does that compare to your studies on Islamic extremism? Or let me, maybe more general, religious extremism.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I think there's something to unpack there. And I have not either had the, you know, eureka moment, or haven't put in enough work on it to get there yet. I think that it is something that I'm interested in exploring if, you know, I have the opportunity. I'd be also interested in hearing somebody else's views on it. But, you know, ultimately, a key difference between, you know, ISIS and the National Socialist Liberation Front is that, you know, you can't sign up to be white if you're not, if they've deemed that you are not. And you can sign up to be part of ISIS. You can sign up to be, to join the eligible in group of Muslims, and then you have to go further to be part of ISIS, though, because you have to then also subscribe to ISIS's views. But, you know, but ISIS is a movement, and, you know, there may be some, I don't know. It gets very complicated very quickly when you try and start thinking about it. So I don't want to do that aloud in this context. But what I would say is that, you know, the sort of very simple ideas that I begin thinking about this kind of thing, the sort of very simple ideas that I might have come to it with very quickly, you know, get torpedoed, and it's much more obvious to me that there's, you know, there's like a lot of complexity in these questions. I will say that, you know, one thing when we talk about fluidity, though, just a qualification that I want to make about this is that extremist groups, you know, almost always, as part of their, what makes them extremist, they will articulate very rigid rules for who's in and who's out, you know, who's in the in group, who's in the out group. And, you know, whether you can make a transition from one to the other, you know, these movements are often really, you know, obsessively focused on articulating the rules under which you can be part or not be part. And that articulation of those principles is predicated on an idea of rigidity, to the point that some people even define extremism as being about rigidity, about, you know, having rigid identity formulations or rigid beliefs. And what we see is that even within one person's lifetime, extremist views are likely to evolve and change. You know, for Mason, it was going from Joseph Tomasi as a role model to Charles Manson. You know, other elements can change. Certainly, we've seen, you know, from Azzam's ideas evolved into Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda evolved into ISIS. You know, whatever Azzam might or might not have thought about that evolution, it's clearly an evolution. So even though these groups are, you know, will tell you endlessly about the immutability of their ideas and the immutability of their group boundaries, even within a single lifetime, you will see those boundaries change, and you will see those beliefs change. So, you know, extremism is not necessarily more fluid than anything else, but it's definitely as fluid as anything else. Extremists will tell you that they, you know, they're based on immortal, unchanging principles, but that is just not true.
So then, when it comes to critiquing, you know, crafting in-group critiques, you know, how does Siege inform us of how the in-group, how critiques evolve and are expressed within the in-group?
Well, I think what the message, what I took away from Siege, was more about how the critique of the in-group affects the strategy. So because Mason's critique of the white eligible in-group is so negative, he believes there's no point in trying to win hearts and minds from that eligible in-group. And therefore, the only thing you can really productively do is destroy the system that's propping up, you know, all this corruption and hope for something better in the future. So I'm not sure that I brought a lot, like took a lot of insight about how that critique developed for Mason so much as how the critique as it's expressed in the piece then influenced the prescription for an extremist solution that he had. The study I did of British Israelism was more helpful in sort of understanding that, you know, how the legitimacy and purity spirals can drive these changes, where these critiques come from, because the British Israelism to Christian identity transition is really one of, you know, a movement from being something that's really not extremist to something that is extremely dangerously extremist. And so that kind of long look is, you can see it happening more. And what I'm seeing in also, as I sort of turn my attention to the ideologies of slavery, what I'm seeing is, you know, a lot of that kind of process happening there too. And the question, you know, for me, as in terms of my dissertation, is whether I want to try and delve into the history of that, or if I want to stick to my kind of mission statement, which is I'm going to analyze texts. So, you know, so the question is, like, you know, this slavery, the pro-slavery arguments were very diverse. So I can't probably just pick one pro-slavery text and analyze it as if it tells us what we need to know. But the question is, you know, do I take three texts from 1850? Or do I try and trace it from, you know, 1700s forward? You know, where do I want to draw that line? And, you know, my initial pitch for this dissertation, of course, was I was going to do everything, do it all and have it all and, you know, cover it from every angle. And now I'm more like, you know, okay, you've already written like 80,000 words and you need to start moving toward a conclusion. So you're not going to be able to do it all. So
when we, something that was interesting that you brought up in the paper was this idea of a consensus reality that I guess, like, when you look outside, when you are part of the out group and you look at the in group, it seems like there's this idea of a consensus reality that the group you're looking at has more agreement than what is apparent. But when you, the in-group itself has to establish a consensus reality. So in terms of like your examination of Siege, did that challenge your idea of how consensus reality is created in the in-group? Did you just say, yeah, that's about right? Or how did you approach that?
So I have some evolving thoughts on that'll be in the dissertation in more detail. A lot of this came out of my literature review, which I'm sure some of my critics would probably point to the fact that literature is often not my strong suit. So I'm a big reinventing the wheel kind of guy. And, you know, that is the personality that I have. And so, you know, when I sat down to do the literature review for my dissertation, it, you know, was really interesting and helpful for me. And I don't know, I maybe didn't do it any totally the normal way, but one of the things that I really did was sort of trace the ideas of social identity theory, which is where we get all these in-group and out-group kind of terminology. And I really traced it back to, as far as I could go, to its origins. And what I found was a lot of literature about these social construction of reality, and the fact that, you know, something that I think I had understood intuitively and had put down, I had put down in various forms, including there's a section in Optimal that talks about it, that's sort of based on a anecdotal example that I had been using for years. It's pretty easy to understand how social consensus drives our understanding of reality. When we are unsure about something, when we encounter something that is, we requires information beyond what we can immediately ascertain ourselves, then we have to start trusting other people to give us information. And so which people we trust and how much we trust them become really important questions. And so what the research shows is that when people are experiencing high levels of uncertainty, such as, well, I don't know, like a global pandemic, for instance, they will look to their identity group for reinforcement when they get information that's in conflict. So you hear all this stuff about this disease and you're not sure what to believe and you're experiencing acute uncertainty, then you will reach out to the people who are most like you to get information. And if the people who are most like you are recommending that you eat horse paste, then that's what you're going to do. And so where I think something that, you know, we talk about, and I myself have gone back and forth over the years about how much social media impacts society in novel ways, right? You know, is social media just amplifying things that have always been there in society, or is it like creating new dynamics? And one thing that I think that is a new dynamic, and this is something that is really kind of the key theme of Optimal, is social media gives you a way to measure consensus. You get an instant measurement of consensus. If you post a tweet with your opinion, and your opinion is, I think we should eat horse paste to cure COVID, you get immediate feedback on that. And if you get a bunch of likes on that, you can quantify the likes you got on that. You can quantify how many people read it. If you piss off a lot of people who are you consider to be in your outgroup, then so much the better. So this development of consensus in an in-group is something that would have taken a long time, that used to take longer. It could still happen very quickly, especially in small groups, but in large groups, it took a while for information to disseminate, for the dissemination of information to produce a clear winner. Now we have a cycle where, you know, if I put out, you know, an opinion about COVID that, you know, it's being caused by aliens from the planet Zebulon, I get instant feedback. That idea gets stress tested immediately. And, you know, and the threshold for what I need, the consensus that I need to feel good about it, can be quite low. If I get, you know, depending on who you are, you know, if you're new to social media, or you just operate at a relatively small level, you know, you get 50 retweets and you're like, you know, tweeting a joke about SoundCloud. Here's my SoundCloud, you know, as opposed to somebody who gets like 1,000 retweets or 10,000 retweets. So, I mean, all this stuff, just, I think it just moves us faster to sort of, like, you know, into potentially dangerous and untested areas. And it's, I think we're, you know, I think we are decades away from really understanding the impact of this on our society.
With that, like, I think we've gone all over all the questions I had. So, per tradition, you know, leave us with something to think about, you know, about Siege, about in-group, out-group dynamics. Leave us, the audience, the listeners, something to think about and something to go home with.
So I guess there are a lot of pieces of this that interest me, you know, going forward. And I think that, you know, I'm setting up a lot of future work for myself and hopefully for other people who are also interested in these same questions. To me, I think there's a really kind of fascinating question about what the anatomy of extremist belief is. And, you know, is it, you know, two parts hatred for the outgroup and two parts disdain for your own in-group? Or is it, you know, three parts this and four parts that? And I think, you know, my work on my dissertation, out of all the questions that kind of are associated with these things in my mind, the question for me that I keep coming back to is really how power and dominance affect these questions. So if your in-group is the dominant in-group in any kind of particular setting, then, you know, how are you going to define an out-group, and how are you going to define extremism in a way that reinforces your domination? So, you know, what to me is really a kind of fascinating question. You can, so if you read a lot of this content, you can experience this, subjectively experience this pretty easily, but to sort of quantify it and articulate it and codify it is harder. Is, yeah, if you, there's as you know, I've read a lot of dystopian fiction, both for fun and for work. And one of the things that is really fascinating to me is how much better written Black nationalist dystopias are than white nationalist dystopias. There's a quantitative difference that happens when you are the dominant group, when you are in charge. It often produces content that is really toxic and really dangerous. Whereas when you are the minority group, when you are not the dominant group, sometimes you get stuff that's really nuanced and interesting. And I you know, and not all the time. So I don't want to overgeneralize it, but I think it's a really fascinating question, is sort of, you know, and, you know, my definition of extremism that I put forward in my book, Extremism, is intended to get us away from the framing that exists in the academic literature and the policy literature, which inevitably makes extremism a fringe function. Extremism can only be unpopular. It can only be something that's held by a small minority of people who are totally outside the status quo. And that definition doesn't allow you to look at the Nazi Party in Germany in 1936 and say those are extremists, because they're popular, they're mainstream, they're the mainstream. So they're not the fringe anymore. So I'm really interested, I think, ultimately, you know, for whatever work I do after this dissertation is over, I'm interested in how affects an extremist orientation. And I think that this in-group critique, so far, the work that I've done suggests that this in-group critique is often more intense for a movement that is not successful, that is not popular, that is a sort of the traditional extremist movement, and that it's kind of a fringe activity that's off on the sides and outside the status quo. And what I want to compare it to, and that's why I'm doing slavery for my next case study, is I want to compare it to extremism that is clearly in the status quo. That is like, you know, this is a country that's like built with an acceptance of slavery, and these defenders of slavery are defending the status quo. They are not representing a small obscure fringe. They are, you know, a plurality of the United States, and they are a majority of the Southern United States. So how does that power relationship affect the narratives that they put out there? And then how does that change when the movement comes under fire? So, I mean, what we see really in the case of slavery in particular is that a lot of its ideological articulations take place right before the Civil War, because they are articulated in response to a challenge of the legitimacy of the institution. So ultimately, I think, you know, how extremism functions and plays into or subverts power dynamics, I think that's like a big iceberg that we've only seen the tip of in our study of the field. So that's kind of where I'm going with this.
That's awesome. So that's the show. That was my guest, J.M. Berger, the author of A Paler Shade of White, Identity and In-Group Critique in James Mason's Siege. He's also the author of two books that I'm kind of vibing on and enjoying right now, Extremism and then Optimal, which is science fiction, but just as good. Again, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I always enjoy the Loopcast.
Thank you.